Hi, my name is Alejandra Salemi, and you're listening to the Healing Theology Podcast. Everyone, welcome to another episode of the Healing Theology Podcast. I am very excited for our guest today. I'm excited for all of our guests, but I'm particularly excited for this guest. Today, I have my dear friend, Sharizna Jean-Marie, with us for the podcast. A little bit about Sharizna. She is an ordained minister in the Christian Church in the Disciplines of Christ. She is an anti-racist activist, a spiritual coach, a social entrepreneur, a daughter, a sister, that auntie, and a wounded healer. Sharizna, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
I am so excited to be on this podcast. We've been talking about this a few months back. So to see this materialize is an honor. It's just awesome to see and an honor to be a guest. So I'm glad to be here.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, Sharizna has been part of a really fun cohort that has been helping us get our social entrepreneur think tank ideas up and off the ground. And so we have truly talked about this podcast since October, I think. You know, there's so much about you and your experience and what you do and how you move through the world that I think is such a perfect embodiment of the intersection of like religion and faith and like interacting with the world, anti-racism, social justice, and obviously health. And you started this company called the Co-Conspirator Institute. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and how your work bridges social change and public policy through a theological context?
Yeah, so I started a nonprofit called the Co-Conspirator Institute. And it is, our mission is literally to do the work of building beloved community by creating space for people to reflect, to grieve, to heal, and be transformed from the white supremacy culture. We approach anti-racism work differently. We really try to approach this more from like a mindful approach. I think there's a lot of theories that are out there, a lot of trainings, a lot of head work. And our work is really about the heart. I believe as an ordained minister with the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ, that transformation is possible. I believe it not just because of something I read, but in my own life, I've seen it work. I see it work. And so for me, I think it is important for us to create intentional space to do the heart work, which does cause for you to bring your mind, your body, your soul, your spirit, all parts of you in order for you to be transformed. So in our work, whether it's the anti-racism part of the work that we do or the work, the programs that address racial trauma, it's all about intentionality and sacred space. And ultimately, I tell people, this is our vision statement, what I imagine when we are done with our work. It's simple. White people are transformed, communities of color are healed, and beloved community is realized. And I am okay with the idea that I may never see it in my lifetime, but to do the work and contributing for this to be possible for my children's children is something that excites me.
Yeah, it's so beautiful every time I hear you talk about the work that you're doing and the way that you come about it from a place centered around justice and liberation. And I think, you know, if I can share a little bit about myself personally, the way I see my work in public health and in religion theology is also centered around social justice. Like the intersection meets at justice and liberation for both disciplines. And I think it's true with the work that you're doing. And I, you know, the healing work, it sounds like you're talking about it from a spiritual sense, but we'll talk about it later in the podcast. There's so much physical and mental health healing that happens when we address these really kind of hard traumas that not only live in our bodies, but get passed down generationally. So I'm sure we'll talk about that later in the podcast. I remember one of the first conversations you and I had when I first met you was a conversation about you reframing the story of Mother Mary, the Virgin Mary, and the way that she wept over Jesus when he was being crucified and killed at the hands of the state. I was wondering if you could kind of share that story with the audience and how you have used this important story to help mothers who have lost their children to gun violence.
Yeah, so at the heart of what we do at the Co-Conspirator Institute is a grief retreat for Black mothers who's lost their children due to gun violence. And we call that retreat Mary's Weekend. And let me also say, the Co-Conspirator Institute is legacy work. I started this organization in honor of my nephew, Christopher Isaac Moran, and I try to say his name every day. He lost his life at the tender age of 20 in December 2019. And so this is legacy work, the Co-Conspirator Institute, in honor of him. And at the heart of what we do is these grief retreats we offer for Black mothers who lost their children. And we can talk about statistics all day about gun violence and who it impacts. But, you know, homicide is the leading cause of death of adolescents in this country. And it disproportionately impacts Black and Brown communities and families. And in my community, in the Black community, mothers are the backbone. Family, community, church, institutions, wherever. It's Black women who's literally the backbone of all these different spaces. And disproportionately, Black mothers are grieving. And when you think about who is the prototype of a grieving mother, for me as a womanist practitioner, when I think about the biblical text, the image that comes to me or the character that comes to me is Mary, mother of Jesus. And while Jesus was not killed by gun violence, he was absolutely killed. He was murdered, and the murder was violent. It was bloody. It was nasty. And it was by the hands of the state and the people who bared witness and who accused him, falsely accused him. And oftentimes in the Christian tradition, we often talk about Jesus' death from a spiritual perspective. But when we think of the historical account of what happened, when we think of historical Jesus, that's the Jesus who's human, right? Not Jesus who died on the cross for our sins. And I think both can be true, right? But we can't ignore the historical account. And as a womanist practitioner, when I think about that story, when I read all four gospels, it is hard for me as a grieving aunt who have no children. So my niece and nephews, they're all like my children. And we raise our children in my family like a village, right? And so Christopher is my child. It is hard for me to ignore the scream, the cry, the heartbreak of Mary at the scene of the death of her child, Jesus. And so oftentimes, and I use the analogy of Easter weekend, and I think the church, when I say church, big C, we do a good job talking and describing and even making space for Good Friday, Jesus's death. And I think we do an even better job of celebrating the resurrection of Jesus on Sunday. But where I think the church needs to re-examine herself is Easter Saturday. And Easter Saturday is where Jesus is dead. Jesus is dead on Easter Saturday. And I think about Mary at the scene of the crime. She was there. All four accounts place her there. She was there at the cross. And I can't imagine Mary being there and not there as the mother of Jesus versus one of his followers. She was there, the mother of Jesus, and she bared witness to the murder of her child. And it was there at the cross where I believe Mary's heart broke. I often say she was so close to the cross that when they pierced Jesus' side, his blood splattered all over her. That's my imagination of Mary being there. Who can stop a mother there at the cross? Who could stop her from going close? And so Mary was there at the cross, and Mary grieved for her son. And it is important for us to re-examine our theology about Jesus' death and resurrection theology as a whole, Easter theology as a whole, that we begin to include grief as part of the story, Mary was there. And so because Mary was there, it is important for us to not just see death as a redemption story for us, but to see death as an opportunity for us to grieve the ones we lost. And so Easter Saturday, it needs to be a very important spiritual practice in the Christian tradition, because as a chaplain, as a minister, and as my own, as a healing wounder myself, Saturday is where a lot of us sit and a lot of us stay stuck because no one is coming to sit with us. I often say we move too quickly from Friday to Sunday. We ignore the weight of Saturday. And Mary, I think, is a beautiful character for us to remind us of the need to sit with our trauma, our griefs, the way in which life be lifing. It happens on Saturday when life be lifing. That's a Saturday experience. And we ought to have a spiritual practice of lament. To ignore Mary's cry is to ignore the love story between a mother and a son. And I think we do that too much in our churches, and it's time for us to tell the full story.
Yeah, as you were talking, I had to look up the stats because we know in U.S. culture that the U.S. suffers a lot from gun violence, but I didn't realize how big of a number it was. It's estimated to be 2,600 to 2,600 children and teenagers under the age of 18 that die from firearm injuries. And this was from 2021. I'm sure that number, unfortunately, has only gone up. And I'm also thinking, you know, I'm thinking of the families that are losing children in places like Gaza right now as well. There's so much mourning of the loss and the unjust and untimely death of anyone, of any loved one, but particularly of children or of people who we deeply love. It makes me think about grief specifically, right? Grief is such an interesting word because it spans both the like religious theological space. We talk about grief a lot in maybe Sunday church or in our religious spaces, but grief and the mental health component of it is also very present in medical research. Grief, sadness, loneliness, these kind of really dark experiences of the human life. And, you know, grief is such a powerful emotion. And when we express it consistently and without ways to release it, I know it can become sickening to the body, right? I've talked about this in previous podcasts, but the trifecta of our spiritual, mental and physical health, it's all interconnected with one another. And so the grief that we hold on to can manifest into illnesses of the body. Unfortunately, these experiences of painful and traumatic loss of life happens in certain communities more than it should, disproportionately, whether it's because of systemic racism or over-policing of certain communities over others, or just kind of the way that society has been built around using guns. Can you share with us some of the ways that you have seen your theological approach to grief counseling impact women? And have you seen their health, whether it's their physical health or their mental health? Have you seen it improve in your grief weekends?
Yeah, I appreciate the commentary and also the question, because you're absolutely right. I think that when it comes to our mental health as a society, we're just coming to terms with it being okay to even address mental health, right? It's just becoming a thing that we include in our commentary. Mental health has always had a stigma. And I also want to name that Black folks, we don't get the privilege to have or experience or publicly affirm the need for mental health. We just don't. It's not a privilege we have. And grief is also a privilege that we don't have, specifically Black women. So I focus specifically on Black women for many reasons. And one of the reasons is Black women can't afford to grieve for so many different reasons, whether it's the responsibility that they have or whether it's the stereotypes about Black women being strong and not needing space to grieve. And so when Black mothers come, when we organize and gather Black women, they come exhausted. Many of them come bewildered, confused. Many of them, if I'll be honest, reject the space because there is shame and even guilt to create such a space. It feels selfish to them or self-centered because we have been socialized to not self-care. And when we prioritize our self-care, the assumption is we're being selfish. And so some Black women don't come because of those reasons. Many of our mothers don't come because of the shame and stigma of how their child died. The guilt that comes with being a mother who lost their children due to gun violence, it's these unexpected emotions that come with grief that all comes in the room when we create intentional space. And now that we know this, we name it. Because what you name is what you control. And so we're able to name the various different emotions, the guilt, the shame, the ways in which grief is lonely. So part of our grief retreats, we do embodied self-care practices because, as you noted, grief is embodied. It lives in your body. So we do yoga and African dance, and we do all these self-care body things. We also bring in one of part of my team is massage therapist who comes in, and she specializes in grief and stress, anxiety, trauma. And she offers massages for our mothers, but it's not just any massage. It's not like you go to the spa massage to relax. This is specific. She literally teaches them how to soothe their body when they are grieving in the moment. She teaches them how to shift and move their energy out of their body.
That's so beautiful. I can't imagine the opportunity to be able to release some of this emotion in the spaces that you're curating. And I don't hear you say this. I don't think it's the 2 days can undo years of mourning and grief, right, and pain and the generational trauma, right? But I think people sometimes just need an outlet. They need to be maybe given permission or be shown the like physical pathways to actually get these emotions out. And it's so beautiful that you're curating space to be able to teach people and allow people to really feel these things, specifically women, as you mentioned already, the kind of cultural expectations that we as women, but I'm sure you as a Black woman and the people you're working with, the inability to really tap into those sentiments. You know, as a pastor, as you're ordained and you've gone to divinity school, I know you and I have had previous conversations about, you know, tools and tactics that you have used to get people in your pews to think about what I would consider as a scientist, like preventative health behaviors. Some of the things that come to mind are like mammograms or, you know, heart checks, things like that. Can you share a little bit about how you've employed some of these preventative health tactics with the ways that you interact with congregations on Sundays?
I think it's important for us to have conversations about healthcare. I think oftentimes as faith leader or just faith people, we often think about our faith and we think about our spirit, our souls, but we don't always pay attention to the body. When the truth is, they're all connected. And when you're not spending quality time with all three aspects of who you are not tending to the whole self. And so I think as a leader with influence, it is important to encourage folks who listen to you to tend to all three parts of who you are, right? And so as a pastor, it's important for me to have those kinds of conversations. And one of the ways we do it is we have themes. We follow themes, whether it's heart awareness or breast cancer. One of my favorite sermons and services that we host at the church is Pink Sunday for breast cancer awareness. And I have a sermon that's entitled, God Has Breasts Too. And I talk about the image of the breasted God. And I talk about the ways in which God was intentional when creating us to give us breasts and the ways in which the breast has emulated the creator God, right? Particularly with women, women's bodies. If you want to see or know the image of God physically, I would suggest looking at a pregnant woman. I believe a woman's body is the manifestation of the image of God in the physical form. But when you have breasts, regardless of size, and even the ways in which in our society, our culture, the way we over-sexualize women's bodies, it's hard to have those conversations in public. But in order for us to remedy that, in order for us to interrupt that pattern, we have to talk about the body. So when I talk about the woman's body for breast cancer, what's interesting is women are uncomfortable, but it's the men who are enlightened. It's the men who are encouraged and who says, I never thought about asking my grandmother if she does her breast exams or went for a mammogram. The way we're able to invite everyone in the community, right? And so I ask these questions, when the last time you had a conversation with your mother, your grandmother, your sister, your auntie, the women in your life? And so part of the work I do is having to work with the women to help them feel comfortable to have these public conversations that are necessary, because when we have them, we're saving lives. When we don't have them, people are suffering in silence. I think part of these conversations about the relationship or the intersection between faith practice and health awareness is really about dismantling the ways in which we have, our culture has caused us to be ashamed about our bodies, right? Whether it's mental health or whether it's our physical body, to interrupt it is to actually do it and to educate.
Oh, I feel so just hyped up, revved up right now hearing you talk. You are embodying the dream that I have for faith communities to be vessels and avenues for getting health information in this way. And, you know, I've had a personal hypothesis, and I think you're, you know, one example isn't confirming the hypothesis, but I think it's getting to the idea that I think religious leaders are some of the most influential local leaders that we have in our communities, especially in, I think, communities of color, especially in communities where the distrust in the government or in the medical system is so broken for very good reason. And our faith leaders hold a lot of weight in the words that they say. I think this is true in the Black community. I think this is true in the Latino community. I also think that there's a lot of missed opportunities to better equip pastors to talk about these health behaviors from the pulpit, as you're talking about right now. Divinity schools, I mean, you went to Vanderbilt Divinity School, I went to Harvard Div. I'm currently at Duke watching Duke Div unfold. I don't see a lot of training on how to have well-informed health education from the pulpit. Do you think that pastors ought to be talking to their congregations about public health issues? And if so, what is your perspective on how we better equip them? How do we empower them to give a pink Sunday sermon and encourage mammograms and encourage, you know, heart checks and STI checks and pap smears and all the things that we should be doing to be preventative health practitioners?
So why I'm invested in the church, but also in educational institutes like Vanderbilt, is because there's a disconnect between what happens in the classroom and what's needed in the community, what's needed in the church. In the classroom, it's theory-based, and I get it, right? We need the history, we need the theory, we need to, I get it, and we need to be more practical. Scholars hate that. When I was in div school, I used to be like, I need more practice. I'm a practitioner, right? And so there's a disconnect. And so I think part of the ways that we help this is to be in conversation, to be in community with these institutions to say, what you're doing is not enough. Here's the disconnect. Here's the need. And here are ways that you can support this need in the church. And I think, to be honest with you, for my particular community, the Black church, but I think church, big C as a whole, our theology, we need to reframe our theologies, because a lot of our theologies are so conservative. The idea to talk about breast cancer in the pulpit is something that most people would not do because of the conservatism. And for me, it's like, but women are dying, particularly in my community. Black women are the leading group of breast cancer who are dying, not who's been diagnosed, but who's dying, right? Black women are leading in the death for breast cancer. They're not the leading ones who are being diagnosed. Part of it is because we're not having conversations and educating Black women about their bodies and about the ways in which they need to take care of their breasts.
So you've hinted at this. We've talked about it, I think, in almost every question that I've asked you. But at the center of your work is this pursuit for justice and decoloniality. I can tell that you're deeply inspired and driven by your womanist theology and your womanist perspective. I talk about my own Mujerista theology in the way that I move through the world as well. And that both of those things are rooted in this idea of social justice. I think that's, you know, also an extension of nonviolence and peace. Can you tell us a little bit more about concerns that you've seen deeply embedded in our society that are public health concerns specifically that you're hoping to address through some of the programs of the Co-Conspirator Institute?
At the root of all injustice is racism, white supremacy culture. At the root of any and all injustice, you name an injustice, I can point to you the ways in which white supremacy culture, right, and its systems, right, is the cause root. But what I also realize in my work is it's not enough to deconstruct. While we're deconstructing, it is important for us to also create space for healing, because there's immediate harm that's happening right now. It is important for us to create space for healing to happen. And so I often say in my anti-racism framework, I created the co-conspirator framework that says it is important for us to have identity caucuses, because the work looks different depending on your social location. White people, it is their primary responsibility to deconstruct white supremacy culture in white communities, because that is where it's bred, that is where it's seeded, that's where it started, that is where it's passed down, that is where that trauma is located. And white supremacy, the practice of white supremacy, racism, is a form of trauma. This idea that you are superhuman, that is trauma. Trauma in a way that we don't talk about, right? And I think in Black and brown communities, it's important for us to do the work of healing, not try to deconstruct white supremacy. It ain't in our community. What's in our community is the impact it has, right? What does it look like to be in Black spaces and to heal from white supremacy culture? So the way we set up the Co-Conspirator Institute is we have consultation and educational systems for white people to do that work, right? And then we have programs that's rooted in racial healing. And so we talked about Mary's Weekend, and there are various different programs like Brunching While Black, because it's this idea that Black people are experts in racism when that's not true. We're not experts. We're experts in the experience, but we're not experts in racism. Oftentimes, stuff has happened to us and we don't even have language for it, unless you're in the field. And so Brunching While Black is an event where we host, because breaking bread is intimate in our community. We often talk about in our community how it's a feeling and folks don't understand it's a feeling. And I can't point to it, but I just know it's there, right? Being able to create space to talk and to examine and lean into that feeling, because oftentimes that feeling is ignored because there is no scientific proof, right? So that's Brunching While Black. We've had hosted, and there's just so many great responses to the community for that space. Another important conversation that needs to happen in our communities, and it's part of our programs that we hope to do in the future. It has not been launched yet, is the work we do with Black fathers and their sons to talk about masculinity, to talk about what it means to be a Black man. And that's a loaded question. And it's layered when you are raising Black boys. In our community, we are the only group of people who have to talk about what it means to be Black as it relates to authority like policing in our community, being able to sit down with our children to say, when you are in the presence of police, these are the things you need to do in order for you to come home safely. The only group of people who have to have that conversation. And so what does it mean to be Black and to be a man and to be raising Black children? And what does masculinity look like? Healthy masculinity. We could talk about toxic masculinity. We need to talk about toxic masculinity. But how do we create a world where Black men can feel whole, can feel like a whole equal human, and it not be toxic?
Wow. I think, you know, if there's one goal that I have for anybody who's listening to this podcast, specifically from the public health perspective, is that they see the ways that nonprofits and religious organizations like yours are tackling massive public health issues from a way that is deeply rooted in addressing the whole self, addressing the human experience. you know, one of my biggest goals for healing theology is to really bridge these communities of scientists and theologians and people in these intersections, because sometimes I've heard people talk about these two fields as if they have nothing to do with one another, or that the approach or that the end goal is nothing alike. And I think you're embodying the harmony between the two of addressing these issues that we know are impacting individuals, communities, families, and even affecting our society as a whole. And you're doing it from both a religious perspective and having immediate like health, or hopefully having positive health outcomes from it. I can't believe that's most of our time now. I want to ask you just five kind of what I'm calling the Furious Five that I'm asking all of my guests. So feel free to give me whatever comes to the top of your head. Can you give me a summary of how you would describe the intersection of public health and religion and how you find yourself at that intersection?
It's all connected. Again, we are three parts in one: body, mind, spirit, or often body, soul, spirit. And so for me, as a faith leader, but as a woman of faith, I have found in my own experience, but also in my practice as a womanist practitioner, is it is not beneficial to practice one and ignore the others. If you want a healthy self, it is important for us to embody and lean into all parts of ourselves for holistic well-being. So those intersections are necessary. We're the ones who separate them. God has never separated. When we think about the practice of Jesus, when we think about Jesus, historical Jesus, Jesus is constantly connecting the mind, the body, and spirit. And I encourage us to do the same. I believe those disciplines should always be in conversation. It is a disservice to humanity when we separate those disciplines.
I'm going to take that audio clip and paste it all over the Healing Theology website. It would be a disservice to humanity to not talk about these intersections. If you were to talk to someone also wanting to do similar work as you are doing right now with religion and health, what advice would you give them?
One of the greatest advice that was given to me when I started in ministry was, before you become a public figure, make sure you take care of your personal issues so that you're not, and this is a figurative speech, you're not bleeding on the people. So I think when you are someone who has interest to serve, it is important that you first serve yourself, right? And so how are you caring for yourself? Right? How are you taking care of your mental health? How are you taking care of your physical health? How are you taking care of your spiritual health? How are you taking care of yourself?
Can you tell us where you are finding joy these days?
I am finding joy with, I have this four-legged child of mine, Teddy. He's sleeping underneath me. And so, you know, he's a service dog. He's an emotional support dog for me. I'm still in my grieving journey. And Teddy has been such a great addition to my life. He's been an emotional support for me. And I find joy in spending time with Teddy. And always I find joy spending time with my family. I'm actually headed this weekend to go spend some time with my 82-year-old mom. And I'll spend a whole 2 weeks with her. So joy is always with the people that I love and care for and who I know love and care for me.
On the topic of religion and health, do you have any recommendation for our listeners, whether it's a book, a podcast, a show, anything like that?
So I was thinking about that question, and I'll just tell you the books that I'm reading. I'm part of several different book clubs, and some of these books are displayed here. Group of girlfriends and I, we wanted to, and I don't know if there's so much healthcare, but again, this is more mental health. This is more about tapping into your creative self, tapping into the ways in which you and your personality is calling you to create in the world. And so Awakening Your Genius is a book that I am reading currently with a group of girlfriends. And then finally, this is one of my conversation partners. She just wrote a book. It comes out in May, Does God See Me? And she talks about grief and trauma. And this is such a powerful, necessary book. It's practical, it's easy reading, but it's necessary when we think about, again, what needs to happen in the academy in order to prepare future faith leaders in the church. this is the kind of book the Academy needs. And so I encourage you, Does God See Me by Jhulla Prevalon. And this is definitely a book that I want to recommend and another book that I'm reading as well.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And we will tag all of these in the show notes as well. So if people want to check them out and buy them, you can check on the episode's show notes and find the links there. And lastly, where can people connect with you?
Yeah. So the Co-Conspirator Institute, if you want to connect with us, you can go to co-conspiratorinstitute.org and leave us a note in terms of how you want to connect with us and ways that you want to hear more about our work. We're also on Facebook and on Instagram. Yeah. So reach out to us. We'll love to connect with you, see ways that we can continue this conversation.
That's amazing. And we will connect all of those links on our show notes as well, so you can follow them on all of their social media accounts. Sharizna, this was so lovely. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your vulnerability, your story, your passion, and your wisdom with our listeners. If you're still hanging around with us, thank you for sticking with us through this really special episode. As always, be sure to subscribe and like and share and do all the things that we do on social media platforms. And I look forward to connecting with you in the next one.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me. Thank you so much. So appreciate your work. So need it.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to the Healing Theology podcast. Special thanks to our video and audio editor, Emily Nagamoto. Thank you for our illustrations from Katie L., who you can find on Fiverr, and original music by Mosado Music, who will be linked as well. If you want to find out more about our podcast, you can follow us on all social media platforms, and you can find the link tree in our bio for where to find us. You can also follow us along on healingtheology.com. Thanks for tuning in.